Good evening. Has this been an incredible gathering? It certainly has been for me. I think love works. It works for me. And I think it really goes to the heart of what we need to be concentrating on, how we need to understand our faith, our actions, our way to be in the world. I want to shout out some of that love to the elders who have been accompanying me here tonight and for months in advance of this, and particularly Janice Dominic, who's been my primary accompanier and is really holding the space for us all tonight, and there are many others in the room doing the same. I think it makes it possible for us to take bigger risks and to really stay faithful to our guides. I wanted to start by telling you how I got into this work, which began when I was in my early 20s. And I was working in Sacramento for the Friends Committee on Legislation of California. And we did a lot of corresponding with prisoners as part of that work. And one man started writing to us about his health problems. And my boss, who was also my mentor, said, "You know, this man can't really tell us the whole story in letters because all of his letters are read. So we need to go visit him and get the full picture." Fortunately, there were only 12 prisons in California then, and he was at Vacaville, which was close. So we told him we were planning to come. And he immediately said, "You know you're busy. I'll understand if you can't make it. It's really okay." So we heard that. And I think we had a kind of a picnic on the way down in the Vacaville Hills. It's a pretty day. But as soon as we entered into the prison, all conversation between us ceased. It was like the building had control of us or the system had control of us. I don't really know. I do know that my mentor was afraid to take me there because he was afraid I would lose my innocence. That was a long time ago. I had my innocence. So we waited silently without anything to read because we're not allowed to bring anything in, and everything takes longer. So we waited some more, and finally he was brought out and he walked over and reached out his hand and said, "Thank you for coming. I haven't been visited in 13 years. I probably couldn't survive 13 weeks without somebody caring about me, reaching out to me, wanting to see me." One story that he told us was about the fact that he had had a window in his cell, and he could see the sunset from the window. But he made the mistake of telling a guard about this sunset experience. And the next day, he was moved to another cell. That's what I began learning on that first visit. So, love in the belly of the beast. I think friends are much more familiar with the love side of things than with the part of my title about the belly of the beast. Our tradition emphasizes that of God in each of us, and we don't dwell on concepts of, dare I say, original sin, Indeed, the S word is virtually never used among FGC friends. And if it comes up, we probably shake our heads and think we're in the wrong conversation. I really don't want to talk about sin at all. It's too tied up with individual failings, with personal wrongdoing. I want to do something even scarier, which is to talk about the E word, capital E, evil. I've come to believe there truly is something called evil out there. And rather than go to a place of denial, we really need to get acquainted with it. The E word for me is about systemic realities that force us into violent and abusive cultures, which are almost impossible to resist or overcome. I'm going to say that again. Evil, for me, is about systemic realities that force us into violent and abusive cultures, which are almost impossible to resist or overcome. As with sin, we don't go there much. We prefer the positive. But is it possible we don't go there because most of us have had the luxury not to? Most of us are people of privilege, whether based on our color, our economic status, our educations, our location in the dominant culture, or all of those things. The kinds of horrors that might put us smack up against capital E evil could be living in a war zone, living in a domestic situation that feels like a war zone, or living with a skin color other than white, or living in prison. These are just a few examples. If we found ourselves in one of those social locations, the idea that evil exists might be really hard to miss. I work on prison issues, so the beast that I want to unpack is what goes on in these very hidden institutions. There's a very high level of violence engaged in by keepers as well as the kept. Distrust and suspicion are the ruling factors, not sometime things people learn to engage in after they've been betrayed. People in prisons are constantly confronted with decisions to kill or be killed, show gentleness and vulnerability at your own peril, demonstrate leadership at the risk of indefinite isolation and additional punishment. The environment is so toxic that surviving is a constant struggle, and the chances of achieving something like wholeness are remote. Is there a way I can describe the flavors and smell and taste of this place? It could be the smell of blood or urine or feces, but they are probably masked by detergents and disinfectants, or with fresh paint recently laid by an enslaved prisoner. Or it could be the smell of bureaucracy, enclosed in rooms full of orderly files and matching furniture, and uniformed or suited officials who have learned to separate themselves from the offenders or the inmates they are protecting us from. Or it could be long reflecting hallways, shiny, clean, that purposely give you no sense of direction or way out. The environment is sanitary and sanitized, hierarchical, to minimize the possibility that even the staff will think for themselves. Bound in regulations and procedures, few of which seem to create care or consistency or to minimize abuse. Immeasurable harm to the human soul results in this belly. And I'm talking about the soul of the keepers as well as the kept. To further illustrate this, and you might not want me to further illustrate it, so I want to just put in a little promise here that although we have some hard work to do this evening, we will get to that love place. There is light at the end of the tunnel, and in fact, to me, there's more light tonight than when I arrived because of so much activity going on in this community. So to further illustrate this, let's talk about the third Harry Potter book, which is called The Prisoner of Azkaban. And it contains some important wisdom about prisons and also about the human condition. One incredibly insightful characterization this book offers is of the creatures whose job it is to guard the prisons. They are called Dementors, and their role, ultimately, is to suck the soul out of the people they guard. It says so, right in the book. I don't want to demonize all guards who work in prisons. They are human beings, just like us, looking for a job that pays well, well enough to raise a family, and even provides health care. Many are decent human beings who look for opportunities to have a positive impact in a difficult situation. But the prison system itself, in very significant ways, is designed to suck the souls out of people deemed to be criminal. And we give the system that right. What does this do to us as a society, as a people? A small example of this happened to a woman in one of my women's groups, facilitated in the federal women's prison. It was her birthday, and she decided to throw herself a party with a few friends. She was sitting with these friends on her bunk, surrounded by a few candy bars she was able to purchase from the commissary to share. A guard came by and saw this scene and broke it up and confiscated the candy. He gave no particular reason for this action, and they were breaking no rules, but he just thought there must be something wrong because they were enjoying themselves in prison. Or maybe he was just having a bad day. The system allows him, even encourages him, to take out his pain on others. The women had absolutely no recourse, and they knew it. To me, the beast is the embodiment of this evil system, an intense harming force. We are all in its belly, drowning in its toxic juices as it swallows up our resources and delivers up more dangerous people to a world that is trained to hate them and block them from thriving on the outside. I know it's uncomfortable to stay in this place, and we can't find our way out without knowing what we are dealing with. So I need to lift up some specific features of the system to illustrate the toxicity in this beast's belly. It's not possible to give a full overview of this very complex system, so instead I want to focus on two features that I think drive us deeper into the belly: racism and the use of solitary confinement, which qualifies as torture by the United Nations standards. First race. The U.S. incarcerates African Americans at a rate 8 times greater than the incarceration rate of Africans in South Africa at the height of apartheid. We hold up apartheid, don't we, in South Africa as sort of the worst example of racism we can think of? Please understand that we engage in these practices ourselves. Indeed, this state of affairs is now widely being labeled the new Jim Crow. And I want to read from Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Color Blindness, to further illustrate how this works. But first, I want to stop and define Jim Crow, because it's always possible that everybody doesn't know what that means. Jim Crow refers to a period mostly following the practice of legal enslavement, but it actually began before, where there was a different set of laws for African descendant people than for the rest of us. So, for instance, it could be illegal for more than a certain number of African descendant people to stand on a street corner together. That double standard also applied to how European descendant people were treated when they committed crimes against African descendant people. Even rape and murder were rarely treated as criminal. That was the atmosphere that we called Jim Crow. So Michelle Alexander says this: what has changed since the collapse of Jim Crow has less to do with the basic structure of our society than with the language we use to justify it. In the era of colorblindness, it is no longer socially permissible to use race explicitly as a justification for discrimination, exclusion, and social contempt. So we don't. Rather than rely on race, we use our criminal justice system to label people of color criminals and then engage in all the practices we supposedly left behind. Today, it is perfectly legal to discriminate against criminals in nearly all the ways that it was once legal to discriminate against African Americans. Once you're labeled a felon, the old forms of discrimination, employment discrimination, housing discrimination, denial of the right to vote, denial of educational opportunity, denial of food stamps and other public benefits, and exclusion from jury service are suddenly legal. As a criminal, you have scarcely more rights and arguably less respect than a black man living in Alabama at the height of Jim Crow. We have not ended racial caste in America. We have merely redesigned it. certain neighborhoods. More people of color are swept up. Then decisions are made by ordinary people about who to keep in jail pre-trial. More people of Anglo-European heritage are released on bail or their own recognizance. Then there are decisions made along the way at trial, if indeed it comes to trial, at sentencing, at classification, once someone is sent to prison. And as one gets deeper and deeper into the system, the gap between people of color and Anglo-Europeans grows wider and wider. So that's the way the stair steps work. You can't go inside prisons without being hit the first day, and I hope every day after that, with the fact that prisons are apartheid in the U.S. That is, a system that forcibly separates people from people for the purpose of exploitation and domination. They are today, and have been since the very first penitentiary opened its doors in the Walnut Street Jail in Philadelphia in 1790. They have always housed the people we wouldn't make room for in our society, culturally or economically. It is shocking. It is stark. It is shameful. The trouble is, it's hard not to get used to it over time. Please don't get used to it any more than you get used to any daily violence and cruelty that you witness. So now I want to shift to solitary confinement. AFSC has been trying to shine a light on the situation of solitary confinement, the fact that we have built entire prisons exclusively for long-term isolation, where people are spending decades in solitary. We've been trying to sound the alarm about this since the 1980s. We've done a lot of research, held conferences, partnered with many other organizations. But the issue didn't begin to get traction until prisoners in these conditions began to go on hunger strike. Initially in July of 2011, this was in California, then again in the fall of 2011 for 3 weeks each, and then in July 2013 for 60 days, 30,000 prisoners joined this third strike for the first week. And we think 100 to 200 people stayed on for the full 2 months. But it isn't really possible to know because the department keeps the statistics and they define the statistics. So by and large, any time a person took a tea bag off their food tray, which doesn't have any calories in it, and sticks it in a cup of water to keep hydrated, because you start to lose your ability to drink water. It tastes lousy after you haven't eaten for a certain number of weeks. I've learned these things only recently. So they might want to stick a tea bag into their water so that they can keep hydrated. That's counted as going off the hunger strike. So it's very hard to get these real, reliable statistics. The whole landscape has changed as a result of their choosing this dramatic, nonviolent tactic to call attention to their plight. So I want to show you a video, very short, that the AFSC produced in 2008 that gives you the sort of inside view of what these facilities look like.
The hole, the bucket, the can,
the box, the hole, the bin,
the chiller,
lock up,
maxi,
the shoe,
solitary confinement.
The cell was probably like maybe 7 feet, maybe 9 feet long.
Maybe 9 by 6.
It's very small.
The cell was a windowless cell.
The walls were cinder block.
The floor, it was concrete.
The bed is concrete. There's a small concrete slab that serves as your table.
You had nothing in the room but you.
It's hard to describe nothing.
This your lonely body in a cell that's empty. That's what solitary confinement is.
Metal and cement.
That was it.
Thank you. the light.
There's lights on most of the night.
Double neon light.
The light would be on sometime 24/7. It never went out.
The situation I was in, they never turned the lights on. The lights were out 24 hours a day. There was a big door that closed, and you didn't hear anything outside of the door.
It can get eerily quiet in these places.
Real quiet.
Mostly what you're going to hear is your own breathing. You might hear your heart rate pumping up. And so when there is a noise, it's just nerve-wracking.
Coming onto the tier, it's a heavy steel door, and it opens electrically. Which means you hear.
I really wanted to talk to somebody, you know, just somebody to be there.
You can go days without talking to people, sometimes weeks, sometimes months.
You can't touch anyone.
No human touch.
Except for aggressive touching by guards when they would come in to chain me up to take me out.
Even if you have family, there's no contact visits at all.
There's a glass in front of you with the person visiting you on the other side.
My daughters were trying to kiss the glass and kiss me through the glass.
It was painful. It was very painful.
I've spent 7.5 years in the control unit.
Maybe about 12 years in lockdown.
I was there for 29 years, you know.
Many, many years in solitary confinement.
29 years. Solitary confinement is just as real could be. It could warp the mind.
It damaged you psychologically. You know, because human beings need to interact with each other.
It's not normal to be in the dark for days and days and days on end.
I could hardly sleep. Like, I had insomnia.
Waking up at night in the sweats, panic attacks.
It would trigger something in my nerves when I would break out in hives from head to toe.
I lost track of time.
There's no concept of time. You know no time in lockdown. There's sleep and awakeness. That's it. And the madness in between.
I would try to hear things, try to hear human voices. And sometimes I would imagine that I was hearing noises.
You start hearing things that's not even being said.
And say, yeah. No. Yeah, what? And nobody's answering.
The anger, the rage, bitterness, the anxiety, the nightmares. And as years passed, it just seemed like the walls in the cell began to close in. They begin to close in. You can feel your mind like trying to escape from you.
And what happens is chaos.
Insanity.
They'll say the end of the barrel. That's what the prison officials call it.
Call it maximum security, administrative segregation.
Control unit. Stigma unit.
Isolation.
Special housing.
La Solapa.
You know, on and on and on and on and on.
So many.
I will say torture chambers. No other way to describe them.
Of course it's torture. It's torture in every form of fashion.
So the only correction that I want to make to this, what you just saw, is that it's our estimate that 90 to 95% of the people in solitary are people of color, not 80%. But we can't actually get these statistics because the prison departments don't choose to keep them. We are working on legislation in California which will require them to collect that information. Imagine having to do that by legislation. These security housing units are the last step in that stairway I was describing. The harshest punishment is reserved almost exclusively for people of color, more so even than death row. So in 2011, the prisoners at Pelican Bay State Prison, working across the groups considered to be gangs, got together and prepared to go on hunger strike. It's important to understand the gang aspect of this problem as it plays out in California anyway, because over half the people we keep in these what's so-called security housing units are there for supposed gang membership or affiliation. Notice I didn't say gang behavior. Just their presumed status. And these prisoners are kept in these conditions indefinitely. If you go to solitary confinement for actual behavior, you get a fixed sentence, you know, a couple of years or something like that. But if you're there as part of their gang management plan, you receive an indeterminate sentence, which is very hard to get out from under. It's really a very sophisticated form of racial profiling, since gang identity is usually about racial identity, or assumptions about racial identity made by prison officials. The only way to end their isolation is to agree to do something called debriefing, which involves providing, quote, information to prison officials about gangs. If you don't have that information, or think you might be risking your life to share it, you're kept in isolation. This is a complete violation of international law, yet it is business as usual in California and many other places. And the reason prisoners were driven to extreme measures to address their grievances. So they chose to work across what was considered their gang differences, settled on this revered nonviolent tactic of a hunger strike, and agreed on demands. And you're probably going to ask me, how can they do all that agreeing when they're in isolation? And I'm sorry, I haven't been in jail or prison long enough to explain this. But there is an incredible grapevine. There are incredible communication mechanisms that they tried to bring into play. So we believe that they're reaching this agreement and then carrying it out is significant and historic. They then communicated their plans to groups like ours, which I think John already said, by telling us they wouldn't be successful if we didn't organize on the outside. And the result on the outside has been a statewide organizing of a coalition, which I swear meets every Monday night and has since 2011. You can say it's Labor Day, can't we take a break? It's Memorial Day. No. This group is so dedicated, it meets weekly. And it consists significantly of family members and formerly incarcerated people, many of whom were afraid to speak out before or were protected from knowing about the conditions by their loved ones. So now it's 2014, and we have had 3 hunger strikes in California. And what has come out of these extremely courageous actions are huge. National and international press attention, dramatic changes in administrative policies, a class action lawsuit that is moving through the process, legislative hearings at the national and state levels that are resulting in legislative proposals now working their way through their respective houses. Before these strikes, all the efforts AFSC had made to call national attention to these practices, which constitute torture by international law, seemed to be a drop in the ocean. But we don't really know what impact we're having with the drops we initiate. And I want to add a word about one other action that these same prisoners took between the second and third strikes, and it was to issue a call to end hostilities. They issued this call to their fellow prisoners across these different groups, because the premise of solitary confinement for these prisoners is that they are going to kill each other if they're given an opportunity to get near each other, so they have to be separated. So the call to end hostilities says, let's not fight each other. Let's take that cause away. Now, we don't know if it's having an effect. We do know the Department of Corrections has done nothing to help get the word out. So time will tell, I think. So I want to tell another story. I sit on this thing called the mediation team for the prisoners who went on strike to try to keep communication open between prisoners and the Department of Corrections, which runs the prisons. And that's been an incredible experience for me to practice nonviolence and to constantly look for openings in understanding and in turning this leviathan of a system around. A few months ago, an attorney was visiting one of the key players in the struggle who said to her, "Tell Laura she's too nice." Now, I hasten to say this man had never met me, but he had been in on some phone calls we managed to arrange between the mediation team and the prisoners, or between prisoners ourselves and the department officials. So he said, "Ask her if she finally convinced a slaveholder to give up his slaves, would she be telling him what a great guy he was? Or would she be saying, it's about time?" So then later, in this attorney's same conversation with this man, he was expressing a need for someone to write an article about the historical moment we are actually in now with regard to solitary. And he looks at her and he says, "Ask Laura to write that article." So on the one hand, he was challenging me and my analysis with a very appropriate analogy of this violent and oppressive system. And on the other hand, he was demonstrating confidence in my abilities. My answer to him through this attorney, and then later in person, was yes. He's absolutely correct that the system mimics the horrors of the enslavement system, and that my understanding of nonviolence is that we can't back our opponents against the wall and expect change to happen. We have to treat them with the same high expectations that we treat each other, and then give them credit when they finally get it right. And yes, I would write the article. So I did write the article, and it was published in a newspaper that I knew went inside, so the men would read it. And then since then, we've had correspondence about it. He doesn't agree, of course, with all of my analysis, but what he also told me in this letter was, "I've been reading more up on nonviolence." And so, you know, it's this relationship building process where we learn from each other and we respect each other and we try to find answers. Nonviolence, in my experience, is a series of experiments in love. If I'm meeting with the director of the department, who I don't really respect, can I still bring that sense of faith and expectation to the meeting? If a legislator introduces a piece of legislation that doesn't nearly go far enough, that doesn't begin to eliminate long-term isolation or to stop requiring people to become informants in order to get out, can I still work with her, keep analyzing the provisions to be sure they don't take us backwards, educate people along the way? Is there a way we can move this gargantuan system away from the violent and punitive system it is and toward a new paradigm of restorative justice based on wholeness and healing? It's very clear that a restorative, transformative system cannot exist alongside the punitive one. It truly has to replace it. How do we get from where we are now to that place, to a healing place? The system we are in now is an individualized system that pits victims and people accused of wrongdoing against each other. And let me add here that these are systemic problems, not created by individual judges or police officers or guards, even though, as our society prefers, you know, even though our society prefers to individualize the problems, you know, we'd rather find somebody to take the rap and then go on with the system exactly the way it's been. That's kind of the way we keep these systems in place. So we have this individualized system that pits victims against people accused of wrongdoing, and then we do this funny twist that says the state represents the victim. Indeed, the state is the victim. What that really does is rob the victim of any role in the process other than to cooperate with the prosecution and push for the strongest possible sanctions. The real needs of victims are not addressed at all. Healing is not even part of the equation. In fact, the more broken people remain, the stronger they will be on the witness stand against the defendant. Other countries do this very differently. They actually fully fund victim compensation from state coffers because they see crime as a societal problem, not as an individual one. The money to compensate the survivors is not dependent on prisoners paying restitution. It is provided by the state. Restitution, while a possible ingredient in a restorative model, cannot be added onto the punishment system without simply adding another punishment, which is exactly what we're doing now, actually. We're adding restitution to people's prison sentences, so they're coming out with huge amounts of debt to pay and practically no ability to work. What would real healing look like? Now, we could spend the rest of the evening thinking about this and throwing out ideas. It would look like being heard, like being accompanied in one's grief, like prioritizing people over profit or weapons or lower taxes. Instead of the one-size-fits-all model of the prison system, where we have the same response to every crime and every circumstance, namely incarceration, transformation needs to take many forms, addressing needs of victims, the deficits that may be present in the lives of people who do harm to others, and some kind of accountability for failed systems, whether it's the school system or the social safety net or the need for adequate health care. Real healing is a complex community process that requires us to continuously ask, what will make our society healthy? What kind of a society do you want to live in? Solving problems like this are well within our grasp. Indeed, many people in this room work diligently to address them. And many people in this room go into prisons on a regular basis to do alternatives to violence projects or prisoner visitation and support or any number of other programs pioneered by friends, We know transformation is possible because we have seen it and participated in it. Going back to the Harry Potter book for a minute, there's another metaphor in The Prisoner of Azkaban. The children, who are the heroes of the story, are required to take a class at their school called The Defense Against the Dark Arts, where they are introduced to creatures called Bogarts, who are menacing and dangerous because they can assume the shape of the thing you fear the most. The students know that when the Bogart is released from the cabinet, which is in the classroom, it will take the form of the thing they fear the most. The antidote, which they are taught, is to focus on things that make them truly happy, that make them laugh. There's a lot of wisdom in this. When I'm really in the grip of some serious bad stuff, I may try to get my head in a more positive place, a more prayerful place. I can look around for people to help me get some perspective. That's not always possible for people in prisons who may know their life is in danger if they make a wrong move, or that their sentence might be extended by years if they make a guard angry, or that they may end up in long-term isolation for exerting leadership, which could be perceived as a threat to the institution. Many, if not most, prisoners have very few positive experiences in their lives to counterbalance the violence and abuses they encounter daily. That's why Alternatives to Violence Project is as powerful as it is, because it starts to make, to fill that deficit in some very concrete ways. The same is actually true for Harry Potter. He had trouble countering the power of the Bogart because he didn't have much to draw on, hardly any positive experiences. If our greatest fear is being mugged or raped or losing a loved one to murder, it will take deep work on our part to practice the antidote to that fear. That is, to bring to bear a love even deeper than our fear. If we have already experienced extreme loss or trauma of the magnitude we heard about from Victoria Green on Monday night, it's almost unimaginable to find the inner resources to take the next steps in our lives. And yet she showed us exactly that in the creation of the Amir Healing Center. Our biggest hope in overcoming a system so entrenched and damaging is to create a new normal. Right now, we're really trapped in the belly of this beast that is often referred to as the criminal justice system or the prison industrial complex. As with all experiments in nonviolence, it will take powerful imaginations coming from all over the country to release the kinds of love enzymes that can counter these forces of evil. Maybe the most promising way to do it is to model transformative programs in as many locations as possible. Friends at this gathering have already begun that, and have, because we've been meeting all week in pretty large numbers, and those folks would be happy to create a new Quaker network for action around these issues. And there will, in fact, be people standing at the doors as you leave if you'd like to be contacted about being a part of that network. AFSC is helping to seed and support these efforts, and we can sign. You can sign up, as I said, on your way out. In my soulful singing workshop this morning, we were treated to a story from West Africa about a culture that discovered that discovers a song for each child born into its community. And that song is sung to that person at various important passages in his or her life. And if the person commits an offense against the community, the song is sung to remind them of their true identity. These are the kinds of things we need to experiment with, we need to discover. Not that we can become a culture that has a song for every baby born, but we can learn from each other's practices what modes of healing work and should be tried. We can be crushed by this beast if it continues to squander the public treasury, throw away the lives of tens of thousands of our people, and turn out more dangerous people to our communities. Or we can bring the forces of love to bear. I want to go back into worship with you now, beginning with a brief meditative slideshow. I'm hoping that these slides will be a visual version of what I've presented. They take you inside prisons, so the isolation and grittiness of these places and the impact that they have are manifest. And then I end up by showing some paintings done by Jay Sirapongs, a man on death row in California who was an incredible painter and had a deep appreciation for life in so many forms. I'm sorry to say that my state executed Jay on February 9th, 1999. The AFSC did an art show, a one-man show of his work, trying to show the world what we would be missing if we took his life. It did get national and international coverage, but it didn't save his life. I end with this because the love we bring to bear on these issues is not a one-way process. There's also love coming back to us from the people inside. And I wanted you to be able to share some of that love. Thank you.